conversation about Lutherans and Indians and the history of Indians, especially in the Pacific Northwest. Does that sound?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, are you from the?
I'm from the city, Minnesota.
Oh, right. We'll try to pay attention to the connections between Minnesota and Texas, and the history isn't that different. Okay. I'm Oglala Sioux from Pine Ridge, South Dakota, is where my home is from. And as I mentioned before we got started with the tape, I am doing a ministry which I feel called to do to the Lutheran Church. I am Lutheran, have been Lutheran since I was about 7 years old. My Puritan stepmother really couldn't accept a Catholic. She had six stepchildren, Indian stepchildren, and she couldn't really accept raising us Catholic. And so she liked the Lutheran pastor, and so she decided to raise us Lutheran. So I've been Lutheran, Luther League and Pacific Lutheran University, and all the way through all my life. And I feel called to a ministry to Lutherans. Lutheran lives are fine. They go on in a wonderful way, and seldom really come in contact with Indian lives. And the same thing is true about Indian lives. So why would anybody want to come in there and be between the two? And the reason is, I think that Indian brothers and sisters have some real gifts for Lutheran people. And I also believe that Lutheran people have some real gifts for Indian people. And if I can have a part in that, I would like to do that. You asked for a brief history of who the Indians were and how they got there. Where are they now and how did they get there? And so I'd like to address that. Who are the Indians? The original indigenous peoples that lived in the forest and river valleys and mountains and deserts of this land before those people who arrived from across the oceans came here. They're a very ancient people. The histories of the different civilizations that existed in North America and Central and South America go back way back before what we consider ancient civilization, the Egyptian and Mesopotamian civilization. There were civilizations building cities and supporting large populations of people long before Egypt and Mesopotamia. And it's a very ancient story that begins the lives of the Indian people who are here now. And what I've been doing in this class is sort of describing some of those in terms of answering the question, who are Indians? Indians are peoples of tremendously different cultures. Wherever you go through the United States and you see, quote, Indian, you could be talking about many, many different languages, cultures, belief systems, religions, even physical characteristics. There's a tremendous diversity that's included under the words Indian. And I've been teaching about the Anasazi, the Adena, the Hohokam, the Eastern Woodlands archaic cultures, the mound builders. If you've ever seen anything about these people who built great earthworks, there are the people in the Pueblo area in southwestern United States, the Taos and San Ildefonso and San Juan Pueblo, all of the different people that we call the Pueblo people, desert farming peoples, people who are ancestrally connected to the Anasazi, people who have belief systems that are very interesting and very different. They built houses like apartment houses made out of adobe and mud, and they built them up on under the rim of the great sandstone edges. A fascinating and distinct culture of people. I've been talking about the Huron, the people in the Great Lakes, the Minnesota region, who were there prior to the ones that really have lasted. There were great populations of Indian people in the Great Lakes region, and some of those people are the Huron. And again, the question of who are they? It's real exciting to talk about Indians, but it's real tough because we're talking about some incredible diversity. The Seneca, the Erie, the Petuns, which are also called the Tobacco people, the Wendats is another word for the Huron, the Seneca, the Onondaga, the Oneida, the Mohawk, the Mohicans. These are the kinds of people who lived in your area. And it would, you know, you zero in on one and it's different from another. And the history can be quite different. Who are the Indians? Yesterday I talked about the Northeastern Indians, the Massachusetts, I got another list here. I love these words, and I think it's real important to say them. The Nipmucks, the Wampanoags, the Pequots, the Mohegans. There are different peoples. Different religions, different cultures, different housing styles, different languages. In the Pacific Northwest, then, to sort of get back to where your specific question was, we have the Coast peoples, the Coast Salish peoples, people who spoke Coast Salish. We have them, and you know their names if you're from the Seattle area or the anywhere from the coast. We have the Willamette, the Quinault, the Chehalis, the Ho, the Macaw, the Clallam, the Suquamish, all of these groups of names of people. And they have, well, they're kind of divided between the southern coast people and the northern coast people. And some of the southern coast people tended to be more fisher people. And people who had a subsistence economy based on seafood and moving through the forest and gathering the things that they needed, and building using the woods for the longhouses and for canoes and that sort of thing. We have the northern coast people, the Macaw and the people up through British Columbia, the Haida and Tlingit and Tsimshian and Bella Coola and Bella Bella people, all those kind of people, who some of them were whalers, and they really were an incredible people, built the ocean-going canoes and really were travelers, and that experience continues. There's every weekend Canadian Indians come down to the coast of the Washington Coast area. And Washington Coast people go up there. I mean, they're real travelers. They have that culture, and it still exists. They were people who hunted whale. And there's some real distinctions between those two groups. You also have the high plateau people like the Warm Springs Indians, the Paiute, the Pasco, people whose orientation goes across the high plateau, and they had more contact with the Great Plains Indians, the Sioux and the Dakotas, the Crow and the Blackfeet. And so they might have ridden horseback, and they have a culture that's different because of the different ecology of the area. They had sacred root festival ceremonies because they needed the roots. They were great hunters because they had to cover quite a bit of distance in order to hunt. They lived in underground houses, not the longhouses. This is something a bit evokes the image of a longhouse. But in the plains, they lived in a sod house in the wintertime because it was high plateau was more severe winter climate, and they needed to, you know, greater protection. And then they lived in temporary housing that followed a nomadic kind of pathway in the summer. We have, we have those kinds of high plateau peoples here in this area, the Yakima, the Colville, the Spokane, the Chelan people. There were a tribe of people that lived on Lake Chelan and through this area, and they were traders. And because they were on the edge between the coast and the plateau, and they were mountain people, they would be the people who would travel the passes in the summertime up here through Holden Lake and across, and collect beads and dentale shells and different things that are only available on that side, and carry them through and trade back and forth across. So when we talk about the Pacific Northwest, we have a vast variety of tribes that we're talking about. You can group them into certain groups. I'm also associated with ministry in Alaska, which has ministry to Athabascan Indians who live in the central interior of Alaska, the Inupiaq and Yupik Eskimo people. The Inupiaq live around Barrow and then very far north, and Nome in that area. The Yupik are in the southern Bethel, Kuskokwim Peninsula area, and then the Aleut live on the Aleutian chain, and that's a different people altogether. So, who are Indian? Incredible and a vast variety of diverse people. Where are they today? They are there. This is contrary to the media image of a vanishing breed, declining civilization. Indian life, whether it's in Minnesota, or in Texas, or in the Pacific Northwest, is there. It's very vital. It's very much alive. These people have survived. And I talked about why I do this ministry. And one of the reasons that I do this ministry is because they have experience surviving. And I think we need to know that. We need to know how to survive. They have experience getting out from under oppression, not only external oppression of poverty and racism and prejudice and legal systems, which if you ask the farmers who are beginning to understand economic oppression or political oppression, Indian people are also getting out of a psychological oppression, an oppression Well, I took the time to say the names of many of these Indian people. The reason I took the time to say their names is because one of the forms of oppression in the United States is to mess with people's names. And some of you who come out of a heritage that is from across the waters, you might have experienced this in your own lives where you had a name. It could have been a Norwegian name or a Swedish name or any kind of a name. And when you came through Ellis Island or when you came to this country, your name was not respected. It could have been changed. And this is a history in our country. Another thing that Indians have experienced is an oppression of their language and culture. And we're not the only ones. Language has been messed with. Language has been disregarded, not heard, not protected, not preserved. Culture has been belittled and repressed, and there were laws. How did Indians get the way they are? One of the ways that they got the way they are is because they were repressed in their culture. If they spoke their own language, my mother was taken away from the home when she was a very little child. She was put in a boarding school, and in those years, if you spoke your own language, you were beaten. There was energies all across the United States to turn Indians into Englishmen or the dominant sort of American culture. This is not a unique experience. Ethnic groups always who have come to the United States have been forced to deny their own cultures in order to survive, to repress their own languages. And a lot of elders who came to this country speaking one language, like German or Norwegian or Swedish or whatever, knew that in order for their children to do well, in order for their children to escape some of the real hardships that exist in this country, did not teach their children their own heritage, their own culture, their own languages. And now are experiencing real sadness and regret. And we are all experiencing the loss of crafts and cultures, teachings and wisdom that came to this country and was repressed in an effort to build unity. Indian cultures and languages also have been severely repressed. That's one of the reasons why people are Indian people are where they are at. Other than psychological oppression, there has been military and political, economic decisions made by the leadership in our country, by local communities, by state legislatures, which have acted to take away the property and culture of Indian people. We have had legislation, and in fact this last year fought for the defeat of a piece of legislation which effectively called for abrogation of Indian treaties, which would have been to confiscate properties which are in the hands of Indians now, to turn them over, by abrogating a treaty. And maybe I should stop here and sort of talk about treaties for a second. Remember that I said that these people existed in this land, and they were here. And when they first were dealt with as a people, they were dealt with as a country, as a nation. And the relationships between the first governments that were established in the United States and the Indian organizations or governments or tribes, confederacies, was on a nation-to-nation basis. And our nation negotiated treaties with the Indian nations and made agreements, usually at the point of a gun, but nevertheless made agreements that in exchange for giving up their land, they would reserve for themselves certain set-aside lands, certain set-aside rights. And that is basically what a treaty is. A treaty is an establishment of a contract, an agreement between one nation and another. A lot of people put a lot of faith in the United States negotiating a treaty to settle the issue of nuclear war between the United States and Russia. Well, the United States settled the issue of war between Indians and non-Indians by negotiating peace treaties. And in the treaties, they would agree that certain exchanges would be made. Land would be given over in exchange for land being reserved or set aside. The right for the non-Indian settlers to farm and build houses and live was exchanged for the right to hunt and fish in their usual and accustomed places. Money was exchanged or promised. Education was often reserved by tribes. They reserved the right for their people to be educated. Healthcare was reserved by their tribes. One of the stories about what happened to the native original indigenous peoples is that when these newcomers came, they came with diseases. And in fact, the first people who landed at Plymouth had already, the native people who lived in that area had already been decimated by illness before the Mayflower landed. Half of the people who lived in that area in the Northeast were killed before the coming of the Mayflower.
Was that in colonized?
By disease.
Indians, you mean?
Yes, half of the Indians.
Before any white man came over?
Oh, no. Before the Mayflower. In other words, with the coming of the very first explorers, the diseases began. And their numbers had been cut in half by the time the Mayflower. So in very few years, whole populations of people were dying because of illness. So this is one of the things that they reserved is health care. There was nothing in the system of Indian life to treat the European diseases. And without the health care of the Europeans on the European diseases, more and more people would have died. So this is a part of treaty language.
I never heard of that.
Had the Indians had other diseases that were endemic to them before the white people came? Do you know anything about what?
Well, certain diseases, but nothing at all like the
smallpox.
Like the death that went through. There was an unknown illness that in 2 years, I think it says 30,000 Indians died in 1617 to 1619. That's about 30,000. Yeah. Incredible.
Now the pilgrims came in 1620, wasn't it?
Yeah. So illness was just decimated the people.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, as people move across the United States, we have a system of sharing that is replaced by a system of conflict, that is replaced by warfare, that is replaced by treaty making, and in many cases, that is also supplemented by the either the outright killing of all natives or the removal of all natives from an area. And it's just, as you read your history of Indians, it's just a pattern. You start with a native group, you start with some interactions, some sharing, you go to conflict, you go to warfare, you go to reservations or removal. And it sort of goes like that all the way across, and it happens out here too. Yes?
Weren't there some of the tribes of Indians who were more warlike, more violent, and other tribes very peaceful? That seems to be what I read before, like the Iroquois Indians that were known to be warlike ones. Yeah.
Well, in different Indian cultures, the place of warfare in society was different. In different cultures, and you're talking about the Iroquois, the concept of warfare in Indian culture is very different in many cases from the concept of warfare that was brought to the United States as a result of the imperial plans of Spain and England and France. They had a concept of warfare, an experience of warfare that was totally different from the kind of warfare that the native peoples had. To go out and do warfare was to go out and take property, was to go out and take wives or go out and capture slaves. To go out and do warfare was to gain honor by approaching your enemy so close that you could touch them. If you touched them, that was the highest. It wasn't the highest thing to kill people. It wasn't acceptable. It was not... that was not the most important thing to do, to kill people. The most important thing to do was to touch them. And that was enough, in many cases, to settle warfare.
I was going to say, with when a lot of animals fight within the same species, the idea is not to kill the other animal, it's to get one to back down.
Yeah.
And you don't end up with another dead animal, but you've settled your agreement or your disagreement as to who is strongest, who's going to be dominant.
Yeah. But that's not, you know, that's not the only form of warfare. There were other forms of warfare that were much more, you know,
I'm just
brutal.
Thinking, how much better than wiping the other side out?
And, you know, there were tribes that, you know, were more interested in total removal. And in fact, as the pressure from the east, this is some of the history of the Iroquois, there came a time when the Iroquois Confederacy had to clear out the land to the west of them, and they attacked the Huron villages and decimated them to move the Hurons out totally, because everything that they had always known, their own territory, had been taken over. And so then they moved, and so they had sort of, by then, adopted that policy of removal. So we're talking about who were the Indians, what happened to them, and we had the sequence of removal that was settled either by forced removal, forced relocation, or treaties. You need to know, as an American, that those processes are not finished, that there are still today, we have a deadline of July the 1st, planned by the United States government, a forced removal of over 10,000 Indian people. So the process continues from Big Mountain, from the Big Mountain area, Hopi and Navajo people in Arizona. Hmm.
The land is useful that they want, but then
the land has mineral value.
Has anything been drawn parallels between South Africa?
Mm-hmm. I work with Indian people who have some real strong feelings about a kind of inconsistency between a concern for a system of apartheid, a commitment to ending apartheid, and no care or concern to restoring the lost land rights and heritage of the native peoples in America. There is an inconsistency between standing up for the rights of blacks in Southern Africa and ignoring the rights of Indians in this country. And sometimes we wonder, why is it easier to pay attention to something that's going on so far away than it is to pay attention to what's happening in our own neighborhoods?
Get at someone else's mistakes or property than his home.
So, the history of the relationships between these Indian nations and the United States as a government is not a particularly happy or it's not a wonderful story. It's if you've been listening to Scott, it's part of the evil within. It's the shame in our own family. It's the abuse that has happened in our country and continues to happen. So what do you do about that? You know, we're going to all sit here and feel guilty. We can all sit here now and feel really guilty, and nothing would happen. It wouldn't do anything. It wouldn't help you. It wouldn't help the Indians. It wouldn't be useful. I think in the 60s and 70s, when civil rights was a major issue, there was a lot of this. Sitting around and hearing the pain and feeling guilty. And what do you do with that? What's the next step? How do you, having once in your own life, experience the reality that you as a collective people have hurt somebody, or you as an individual have hurt somebody, which I've done many times. How do I take that reality and do something about it? And that's, I think, part of a ministry, part of a work of the church that connects to the gospel, to who is my neighbor, to healing the sick and setting free the prisoners, and it's a gospel message. It's an opportunity. That's part of the history of Indians. There is another part of the history of Indians that most people don't hear, and that is the continuing survival, the continuing revival, the continuing spiritual strength of a people who survived, who continued to survive, in spite of the very painful and devastating history that they have. Indians are not a problem. They're a people. Indians are not a pitiful thing. They are a people, a proud people. How can you experience that? Wherever you live, there are Indian communities near you. I sort of stuck my neck out yesterday and said, within 200 miles of wherever you are, there is an Indian community. And part of my ministry is to invite you to begin to see them, hear them, experience them. I said this yesterday. It has been said that in the United States, the mean or the average or the middle between the European and the Indian is the American. Mm. That to discover who Indian people are, what Indian people are, what they believe in, what their spirituality is to learn something that's very essential about who you are, about what you are, what you believe, why is America what it is. I am amazed as I study, and I picked a book that I wasn't that familiar with to teach up here, and I am amazed at the roots of what we call the American dream, the good stuff that is American, how much of it is embodied in the culture system and spiritual teachings of Native peoples. It's like people who came here from Europe took some of the best teaching of the classical background and some of the best teaching of the elders in the early years and put them together to create what is the best of America. And I feel real good about that. I feel that it's vital, it's energetic, it's a people who are now able to say, as I do, I am Lakota, I am Mohegan, I am Sioux, I am Taos Pueblo, I am Seminole, and this is where I come from, this is what I believe, this is my name and my history. I think that is a gift to all peoples who are here in this country. It's not a bad thing to be what you are, to name yourself, to have your own language, to be from a different place, to be a mixture of one or another. I think that Indian peoples have been working on being unified in their incredible diversity. And in a Lutheran church that's trying to become unified in its diversity between ALC, LCA, AELC, it has something that can be learned from the teachings. And in a world where we need to be unified, not separated from people who are across the ocean from us, whether it's Russia or Europe or South Africa, China or Japan, knowing how, and I think more than that, not just knowing how Indians have worked toward unity and have failed, you know, we're not totally unified, that's one of the hardest things of all, but also knowing how, knowing the experience of reaching out past a Lutheran culture, a traditional Lutheran culture, and getting to know another culture, whether it's Indian or Asian or Black, and our communities, which are much more integrated than our churches. We are practicing a process that we need desperately for our own inner process of reaching out to people that we're in conflict with, and our own national process of reaching out to other nations, particularly those that we now perceive as, quote, enemies. Scott talks about befriending the evil. You know, we have a concept of evil, and all winter we had pictures around here of the Russians. You know, and not just pictures, but little messages from Russian people, real people, mothers and fathers and children and grandmothers and babies. You know, we consider them to be enemy, or them, or other. We don't consider them to be fathers and mothers and babies and people who really do not have a desire to kill us. And I think that's the same situation between us and Indian people. I have learned so much from being Lutheran. Lutherans are not the kind of people that you say, hello, how are you? And they love you from that minute to the rest of your life. It takes a while for Lutherans to warm up to each other. But once they do, they never let go of you. And that's a real gift. And I think that I'm here to say that Indian people, in the experience of my ministry, which is the Inner Lutheran Native American Concerns, we have brought groups of Lutheran people to Indian people. And I might tell you what that's like. I'll start with 2 years ago. A group of Lutheran people came together in an experience that we call One in the Spirit. We have it every year. We met in Puget Sound on Hood Canal at the Belfair Retreat Center, Christ Retreat Center in Belfair. And we gathered together for the express purpose of helping these Lutheran people get to know and make relationships with Indian people. We invited Indians who are Lutherans, who are in Lutheran congregations. We shared our cultures and theirs. I share my Lakota heritage. Ira Frank is a Haida who worships at Messiah in Auburn, and he shares an Alaska Native culture. Linda Smith is a Tulalip who is associated north of Everett in the Tulalip Reservation by Marysville. Terry Tafoy is a Taos Pueblo and Warm Springs, who, if you've done some Lutheran things in the Northwest, you may be acquainted with him. He shared quite a bit from his culture. We have all kinds of people. And those people made invitations for us Lutherans to meet the people of the Shaker religion at Mud Bay, which is in Puget Sound by Olympia, between Olympia and Shelton in that area. And so we went over there, and they were worshiping, and we went to worship with them. They had a great welcome for us. They made a circle around the outside of the room, and everybody walked around, and every single one of them shook hands with us. And then they invited us to sit with them, and we were experiencing their worship. The Shaker Indian religion is a Trinitarian Christian form of religion, and they teach orally the teachings of the Bible, but they don't read it in terms of words. They teach it in an oral way. And for Lutherans, it was a real new experience because they use handbells, but not in any way that you're associated with handbells. You know what those look like, the little tiny all the way to the big bells. Well, the Shaker people take the bells and ring them in a rhythmic way that is a reflection of their ancient traditional ways. And they ring the bells and they sing and dance and pray. And this goes on for 5-6 hours. when you're sitting in there, and it's an experience that you will never forget. The ringing of the bells and the vibrating of the whole room and the unity of all the people. Little tiny babies with little bells, clear to the grandfather. My daughter will never forget the moment when she had gone outside to go to the bathroom and came out of the door came the elder. And we had been dancing maybe about 3 hours. And the steam is just rising from its body.
Oh.
Just incredible to just experience. And they moved around the congregation and they prayed for the people in an incredibly touching way. Not just touching, but they lived together all the time. And so they knew what was going on in somebody's life. And this person had cancer. And everybody on the floor would go by them and pray for them and touch them. Another person, if somebody really was suffering, like a woman's son had died, and so they put a chair out in the middle and everybody just washed that person, and the bells ringing, and they just washed that person with prayer for healing for the sorrow. And everybody just cried with them, and it was an incredibly touching experience.
They call it Shaker.
That's the Indian Shaker Church, which is not the same as the Shaker people who don't get married and who are dying off on the East Coast.
Yeah.
It's a different religion.
I've never heard of that.
And that was one night. And the next night was an experience where we were invited to the Skokomish Reservation and to the Longhouse religion. The people, the Indian people who worship in a traditional religion, which has been named by non-Indians, the Longhouse tradition. They call it Osion. Osion. They had an enormous feast for us. They had a celebration, a sort of a sacrificial feast where every representation of life was given to us. We had fish and deer and shellfish and chicken and turkey and, I mean, everything. There was just everything, all kinds of root plants and green plants and fruits and the pie. It was this incredible feast. And they invite you in and they serve you. You just sit down and they just can't do enough for you. They give you everything. And then you go into the beginning and they have the spirit dancers and the people. We sat on the outside edge and they talked to us, they taught us, they shared with us who they were and what they were doing and what was going to happen. And the people had costumes, not costumes, but to us we would name it costumes. They had their sacred clothes, and each thing that they wore had a particularly very sacred meaning. And they sang songs, and a person had been going through an initiation with into this through religion. There were seven of them. They call it babies, and they had been going through a preparation period, and they were being initiated into the religion. We do this not so that we believe the same thing as the people of this traditional religion, but that we understand that here is a vital group of people who are deeply connected to each other, who are very much alive, very much open to a hand of fellowship and friendship with each other, people who care that we know them as people who are serious about what they believe in. And that's why they were willing to open up themselves to us coming and being there. And so they had what they called the spirit dances. And each, there's a group of people who are drummers, and they help each other. And so the drummers stand next to the person who's going to dance. And they have a song. It's all a sort of a litany, and they beat the drum, and the person believes that when they cry and they begin to dance with it, crying, they're crying for the whole people, what they do in doing worship for them is doing something for the good of the whole people. And not just their own local people, not just the Skokomish people, but for all people. And so they begin with a deep crying, and the tears just come crying out of their eyes. And they get up and they have a set dance that they've learned from when they were very little. And they dance this dance. And the dance has deep religious significance. It's a part of telling about our relatedness and our connectedness. And it describes an aspect of creation that brings people healing and life and recovery. And we go through, and all the dancers who were there, and again, the Canadians had come down, and a couple of Canadians, and they danced. And the people from Macaw had come over, and they danced. And theirs was a little different. They have a different drum and a different song. But they welcome anybody's work. And they said to us, we were a part of it. We were doing it too. It was important that we were there. And they really just, you had the sense of being needed. The dance is finished and they had a giveaway. Has anybody ever been to a giveaway?
No.
Everybody.
Potlatch.
Everybody in the room was given gifts. Beautiful beadwork, blankets, shawls. You received wonderful things. It was incredible, reaching out of love. A wonderful experience. Something that if you work with anybody from the Northwest who has ever been on it, ask them how it was for them. It's something that people have really talked about. We do this every year. Last year we went down to the Warm Springs Reservation, and there was a Paiute elder from the Feather Religion who spoke to us, and a couple of elders from what is called the Singing Religion on the Warm Springs tribal group spoke to us.
And where then is it? Warm Springs?
In the central part of Oregon. And then there is the Pasco Seven Drums, I think it was Pasco, Seven Drums tradition also was there. So, what we are doing is we are experiencing Indian people as complicated, sophisticated people with many different kinds of heritages and traditions. Many, many of the Indian people are Christian. Down on the Warm Springs Reservation, we will be worshiping with the Presbyterian Indian community. And the task of my ministry is to encourage you to meet Indians and to, a lot of you may have seen beadwork. The grandmothers were telling us about the beadwork that they do, and they also did some knitting. If you drive onto the Warm Springs Reservation and go into the tribal store, you can buy these belts and things that the women have knit. The women talk about how they know that they're selling these things to non-Indians, and everything, every stitch that they make, like you're sitting there knitting, they teach their daughters and granddaughters to knit a prayer into every stitch that they make. So that this to me is a very sacred thing, because I know the kinds of hours of praying that went into the making of a piece of Indian beadwork. The grandmothers teach their granddaughters to pray for the person who will be wearing the beadwork. And so it's just real special to own something that was made by an Indian woman who follows this tradition of praying into every stitch. If you make a sweater for someone and knit a prayer into every stitch, when that person wears that sweater, that person will be wrapped with an incredible gift of love. And And that's the kind of the teaching that the work that you do is sacred, and that, you know, if we were here at Holden doing our work and you're making a bed in the housekeeping, and you pray for the person who's going to sleep in that bed while you make it, and you're doing dish teaming and you're stacking up all the plates, and every plate that you stack, you pray. That would be a traditional Indian thing, a teaching. Mm. That you pray for those persons who are going to eat that food, and you thank, say you're serving the food, and you're saying thank you for the sun and the rain that brought the grasses that came to the bread. Thank you for the life of the deer or in this case the chickens and the cows and things that died in order so that you could have this food. That's sort of the teaching. What a gift, you know? Why not give that to the whole world? People who are bored with life and who don't know what their life is about. They teach us that we are the sacred children of the seventh generation and the 77th generation. And you have a sense that your life is not just for no reason, but you're there somehow because your Creator planned for you to be here 77 generations ago. And this is true. You know, what a teaching that is. Somebody planned, I mean, everything that was necessary, your genetic code was printed that long ago, and things have happened all the way through those generations so that you would be here and that you would carry those characteristics that you have. That's an interesting teaching. The other side of it is that you are the ancestor, not only to the next generation and the next generation, but you carry everything that is the root and the food and the base of the seventh generation ahead. You're responsible to take this lesson of this peace crane, which says no nuclear war. You're responsible to see that lesson is learned. Not because so that you can live, so you won't die, or your children won't die, but so that the seventh generation will experience this beautiful earth, so the 77th generation will experience this beautiful earth. And the genetic code of the future is in your life, and you don't have a right to ignore your responsibility to the future. That this planet is in trust for you. The oil that you take and use when you turn on the electricity will never be here again. The soil that you allow to go into the air when you till the ground will never be come back again. And we teach this continuity and connection between everything. I think it's a gift for the Lutheran Church.
Sense of history.
Sense of the future and the past, a sense of the wholeness of creation, a sense of the sacredness of your own life, that you're sacred and I'm sacred. And it's significant that we're here. It's significant that there's seven people and myself in dialogue with each other here today, asking questions and being taught. It's very significant that I sit in the circle with you and hear the teachings of our elders, the words that are being shared with us. It's not unimportant. In fact, nothing is unimportant. I think that's a gift. Freely, you know, like Scott says, if you like it, if it's useful, if it's helpful, take it. It'd be yours to keep. You can even use it as if you just discovered it, as if it's original to you, because that's all where everything I got came from, somebody else.
Yeah. Have you ever read the story of the history of Metlakatla with Father Hubbard, or Father, it's his name.
Huh?
No, no, that was in Hennepin.
Murray or?
Well, it doesn't matter.
What's his name?
Was it Murray?
Murphy or?
No.
I don't remember.
Anglican.
I remember the story.
Yeah. How he moved his the Tsimshian tribe, a portion of the Tsimshian tribe, from British Columbia over into the territory of Alaska, and got this island, Andan Island, and built a church. And it was, according to what I've read, the most successful missionary group living development or experiment or whatever you want to call it ever was that I've ever read about. And they're still there, but a little strong.
You talked about teachings of reconciliation. 2 years ago, I just was totally knocked me off my feet. It was a lesson for me that I will never forget. I was at World Council of Churches, and the Canadian tribes had commissioned the carving of a totem pole as a gift to the Union Theological Seminary and the University of British Columbia. And for World Council of Churches, they had arranged that this totem pole be lifted up right in front of the Theological Seminary. What is the significance of that event? The missionaries who first came to British Columbia preaching the concepts that the totem poles, because they didn't understand what a totem pole was, because they didn't know what it was about, because they came in with a preset idea. They came in and ordered the destruction of totem poles. Totem poles were burned. The religion was banned. People were arrested. The potlatches were banned. Their life was decimated by the teachings of the missionaries. The people who brought Christianity to that country brought the most rapid decline of everything that they had ever known. When I stood there and meditated on this decision by the elders that a totem pole should be given and erected in front of the Theological Seminary, what an image of reconciliation and forgiveness. What a teaching about turning the other cheek. Mm-hmm. I think it was one of the most Christian things that I have ever experienced. Mm-hmm. Second to, and in addition to the Pope sitting down with the man who shot him. I am really touched. Well, I'm not a Pacific Coast Indian, and I may not be able to do total justice to the concept, but it's, in a sense, almost, there are many dimensions to it, many, many dimensions. One dimension is a kind of genealogy, mnemonic device, a memory device that helps people to remember their relationships with each other.
Let me ask, did you take a Bethel Bible study?
No.
Oh,
okay. It's a device that helps them to remember their relationships to each other, that people were organized according to kinship systems, and those kinship systems could be easily remembered by the fact of a clan. And your clan would have a totem. A totem is an ancestor, a source, kind of. So you, like I am, I'm not Coast, but I am associated with certain clans. The bear is significant in my family. The owl is very significant in my family. The eagle is very significant in my family. Well, in their area, you would have in front of a house a totem pole, which would indicate by the sequence and story, whose house that was, sort of house names. There, you know, this might have the beaver at the bottom. So this is the beaver clan, and that made all kinds of connections for you. It's like saying I'm ALC and LCA. You know, you knew who you didn't marry. If you were beaver, you didn't marry another person in the beaver. You were related to each other. You knew what had happened in the past. What is it that made you significant? For example, if you caught a whale, then you might put up a totem pole that had your clan symbol on it, and maybe the clan symbol of all the people who went on the whale hunt, and a great big whale on it. And that's a historical memory of what it was, of this experience. You could put up a totem pole because a significant person died. One of the real important totem poles around here was done when Abraham Lincoln died. And they carved a totem pole, and they erected it.
So the important thing was that they were not graven images.
Not in the sense that...
They were not idols.
No, this is where the missionaries...
Of what the missionaries say.
Because it looks like...
But they weren't.
I think some tribes in Africa have, I think they call them jujus or something, that they're...
part of it is our inability to translate and understand what is being taught by what is happening. You know, like you might see in the Southwest the people dressing in a kachina and one of the kachinas might represent the sun. Okay, if you just looked at it through your own cultural context, you might think that these people are worshiping the sun. That wouldn't be an accurate interpretation of what happened. That wouldn't be accurately translating the action that's going on there. Yeah. Just like for Janice, I might, in prayer, in this room, pray to the six directions and celebrate in a sacred way the stones, the trees that are here, the trees, the birds. I do not worship the stone or the trees, but I do see the sacred connection between the Creator and the stone. And I think that in much of the expression of culture, this is one reason why I'm doing what I'm doing, is this first half of my teaching series, I have 15 sessions, this is a story about American Indians and Christian missions told by a non-Indian, Henry Warner Bowden, and taught to you by an Indian, which is a different experience than if you had just taken this book and picked it up and read about it. And if you were to hear the tapes, you would get some other perspectives that are not necessarily in this book. The second eight sessions that I'll teach out of a book that's written by an Indian, Alvin Josephy. And the name of the book is Now That the Buffalo Is Gone. And if you're interested in what I've shared today, you might take that book as one book to pick up and read. Now That the Buffalo Is Gone by Alvin Josephy. And the important thing that I want to tell you is that when you have questions about Indians, when you are curious and you want to understand the history of something, it is a totally different experience for you to hear the answer from an Indian than it is to hear it from a non-Indian. Just as if I were to ask Elmer about Jack, I would learn quite a bit about Jack, but I might not understand Jack in the same way as if I asked Jack to tell me about Jack. And that's a principle for learning about Indians, is who is talking? Is it an Indian? And is it an Indian talking about their own experience and tradition, or is it about somebody else? It's scary to me to sit here and talk about a lot of different Indians. I would much rather only talk about Lakota. but there's no way in this one summer that you would get to experience the Massachusetts, the Delaware, the Huron, people from all over. And so I, with real trepidation, speak as carefully as I can.
Now, the Lakotas originally came from, now I say originally, I realize that the Iroquois came clear across the country. Where, the Dakotas?
The Lakota Sioux people originally lived in the Ohio Valley and the beautiful area of rich woodland and river area, the Mississippi, the Ohio.
I see.
And they were driven onto the plains.
Yeah.
During the time of the colonization?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it'd be the...
Right. Yeah. Right, with the introduction of the horse and that at that point.
Yeah.
It is 12:01, and so I, you know, I'm willing to stop, and I'm willing to sit here and answer any more questions.
Yeah, I've got to run downstairs.
Okay.
You mentioned the Warm Springs.
Yes.
I believe it's the same place that they have
thank you
a series
for being
of
here.
Hot springs on their
yes.
land, and then people can come and experience them.
Yes.
Where did they first know of Indian inhabitation?
Isn't that interesting? Because they teach you that Indians came across an ice bridge from Asia. And that's sort of the story that's told. But the first, oldest evidence of Indian life is in Colorado.
Colorado?
Makes that question a little hard to understand.
I thought down around the northern part of South America. They've uncovered so many historical ruins.
In the United States.
Mm-hmm.
In Colorado is in the United States. yes, I agree. That
but they didn't drop in there from the sky.
I don't think so. I wouldn't personally, my own personal opinion is that the peoples have lived in this continent since the continents were united and as one. I believe that that's the truth. When the continents were all together as one land, that's when the first people came to this land.
And you talk about oppression. In the Bible, in ancient, God told the Israelites that he would give them this land, and he destroyed the people and drove them out and give it over to the Israelites. And as far as I know, in my mind, at that time, and it's been that way, the Romans pushed up into Germany and pushed those people. They went over into England, and people were always moving away from oppression.
Yeah.
Mm.
And you talk about diseases, it probably wasn't, who knows what was a Norseman. Seafaring, you know,
mm-hmm.
that brought disease over here.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, actually, there's many, many people, and particularly the Sioux people, believe that they, at some point prior to Plymouth Rock, a Norwegian, Norse, Northern Scandinavian exploration landed, and the genetic evidence that many of the Sioux people found the first contact with whites were observed to be unusually tall, unusually fair. Some had blue eyes.
Mm-hmm.
They really believed that there were through the Canadian a whole strain of people who seemed to have come out of the Viking.
Have you heard of the Runestone that they found up near Alexandria?
Yes.
They claim that the Norsemen sailed their boats clear up into that area, west
yes.
of Duluth.
Yes.
And they found this stone, and there was a message on it, and they
yes.
had it deciphered.
Right.
And,
so we don't have the answers. You know,
no.
We need to understand that lots of times our theories are just
but
theories.
You talk about the oppression of the people for the languages. I believe that this is the melting pot. The United States is the melting pot. And if we are going to continue to succeed, be a success, that everybody must speak the same language so we can understand. I have no objection to them getting together like the Indians do, have their own schools, but they should also be required to learn the language of the country. I would, if I went over to Norway, I would want to speak my language over there, but I would feel as though I should learn that in order to get along. I'm not a Norwegian.
I'm gonna just toss something in. I don't know where I heard it, but I heard someone say, we used to always call America a melting pot.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's more of a mixed salad. A lot of different distinct ingredients that don't necessarily blend together,
That's right. But
can still complement each other. And I think that is one of the, on one hand,
I think
horrible things have been done to Indians as far as stomping them out, but also people have tried to melt them into the white culture, mainline them. And as I understand, many Indians feel that that has been a great disservice.
Very much so. And I think...
that's not just having people who maybe speak a different language also learn English, but that's been where you have uprooted children and put them into...
In my experience, the principle that I come down on and I feel is most helpful for relationships of people is that we should respect the rights of individuals to choose and name for themselves what their identity and beliefs and cultures are, and not to destroy them by action that imposes something against those individual choices. I feel that we have to have so much respect for the sacredness of the qualities that were given to that individual. So that if you wanted to be a person who spoke English only, that I would respect that. And I wouldn't feel it would be appropriate for anybody to downgrade that choice. By the same token, if somebody else came and chose to learn to be a bilingual person, speaking English so they could really communicate with you, but also keeping their own personal history alive, I would think it would be very useful and important to protect that, just because of the sacredness of life.
I don't like your idea of the salad, because there's many ingredients in the salad that turn bad and spoil the whole salad. But you take lead, and you can have many different types of lead, and you put them in that pot, and you melt them. It's all salt. One part isn't going to spoil the other.
Mm-hmm.
They're combined in a perfect metal of their own, see, and that's the way the United States, when we got together as the United States, we were able to stand up against other nations, where if we'd have had a bunch of small nations, like they have in Europe, this one been fighting, that one been fighting, this one. As it was, we came out victorious, and it was our own leader's fault that we didn't win in Vietnam, or we didn't win in Korea.
Well, there's a lot of integrity to the idea, and it was very useful at the time to teach a concept like the melting pot. And that was very appropriate for the time. I'm not sure that is going to be a useful idea for the circumstances and situations we're in now. But there's a lot of integrity to the ideas that people have, and it's important for us to be able to discuss, as we do here in community, being Christian with each other and being able to sit down and care about each other's individual position without requiring that everyone agree, you know, that the image of a salad bowl may be very useful for you in terms of understanding how you relate to other cultures. And the image of a melting pot may be very helpful to you. And, you know, there may be other people who have other ideas. But since we are a family of Christians together, at least we are able to hear that and respect that position, whatever it is that's different.
Mine might be a concept of a faith, perhaps, with many different items that are individual.
A smorgasbord.
I worked in the Arctic Circle during World War II, before I went into the service. And we built an air base.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Catholic priest up there to administer to the Eskimos.
Mm-hmm.
And he had services for the Protestants. And a group of us would go over, and we'd have services, just like we would at home. And then afterwards we would visit. And he went on to tell us, and one incident he told, it was about one Eskimo had oppression or mental problems bothering him, you know. So he asked his brother to shoot him. So his brother took the rifle and shot him. And there was nothing wrong with that. But now in this country, we don't look on that with favor, you see. So we can't have a bunch of individuals coming in and shooting off their members, you know. There's certain laws that they have got to adhere to if we're going to have a decent society. But everybody's got to see it to it that those laws are just, whether it's an Indian or whether a Negro or a Chinaman or what it is. And we've got to enforce, we've got to have a set of laws and we have to enforce them regardless of what it is. And unfortunately, in the past, it's been the superior numbers making treaties, which were the white man. I feel bad about the way they broke their promises, you know. It wasn't necessary. If they found oil in that land that they had set aside for the Indian, they should have smiled and taken their licking and treated the Indian like it was his. But no, they went right in there and said, "Oh, well, you fellas got to move now. We want this for something else."
It may be with the United States being a population of people that are definitely a minority to the rest of the world,
mm-hmm.
that our history of treating those who are minorities among us may come back to us as we experience being a minority in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That there's one thing that we can count on is change, and there will come a day when we will not necessarily always be in the same place in the world that we are now, especially in terms of leadership. And I think there will be a lot to be learned when we find ourselves a minority in the world.